It's Thursday, September 1st, 2011, and you're listening to episode 244 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. You know, I do not want to live in a universe where Muppetational is not an adjective.
I agree completely.
Muppets are awesome.
It's celebrational.
What universe isn't it an adjective?
It's the most sensational, celebrational, Muppetational.
Muppetational.
I don't want to live in a world where that's not a word.
This is what we call Fear the Boot.
And I'm really sorry for the generations coming up if they will have to live in a world that does not have that adjective. And it is the fault of Jim Henson.
For dying?
Yeah, for dying. Selfish.
Yeah, selfish bastard. Yeah.
I must say, I love the man's work, but I'm so glad that I live in a world where Muppetational is not an adjective.
Leave.
So,
hey, there's a new Muppet movie out this year. We're bringing it
back. It will be awful. Because you know why it will be awful?
Because I'm looking forward to it?
Because Jim Henson won't be doing it.
One of the best things the Muppets ever saw was when they had the Muppets on Family Feud. It was like Muppets versus the Dixie Chicks.
Oh my god, how old are you? Really?
This was back in the Louis Anderson Family Feud. And that episode,
I'm sorry, that Family Feud doesn't exist to me. The Family Feud without Richard Dawson is a sad, sad thing. Even when it went to, what is it, Al from, what was that show?
From Home Improvement.
Didn't he do it for a while?
Yeah, I believe he did.
It was Richard Karn.
I like him okay, but Louis Anderson, oh my God.
He took time out of his busy not having an acting career anymore to host the show.
Richard Dawson was a pimp. That motherfucker was a pimp.
He was. He earned his pimp stripes being on Match Game, which is by far the best game show in the history of the universe. You can't beat a game show where half of your celebrity guests are all smoking on set. And there's double entendres in nearly everything that's said. That show, wonderful. Charles Nelson Reilly, f***ing stud.
Definitely no name that tune.
Charles Nelson Reilly is
Let's fun. Make a deal. I'm sorry. Let's Make a Deal wins.
It's too goofy. Hollywood Squares.
You know what? I never really got into Let's Make a Deal. I like old school Price is Right. And
spay and neuter your pets, everyone.
We like Hollywood Squares, too. That was a great show.
Oh, Hollywood Squares. Paul Lynde, man. I'm telling you.
You could fit the whole Brady Bunch.
Told you about my elephant.
Well, I'd like to get off this tangent and welcome everyone to the most...
I'm sorry. Get off this tangent, Dan. This is not a tangent. This is the opening of the show.
Yeah.
There's no tangent.
Well, I want to welcome...
You have to have a circle to have a tangent.
I want to welcome everyone to the most sensational, celebrational, Muppetational podcast on the internet. Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
Hold on. I'm going to pee on a Muppet here. My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
This is Johan.
And hi-ho, this is Chris.
I love it when he calls me that pet name.
I was about to say, only I can call Pat Ho.
Hi-ho, Kermit the host here.
All right, well, we do have something else kind of dumb we have to deal with here. It's Wayne's birthday.
Oh, is it?
Wayne, how old are you today?
31.
31.
Oh, my gosh. When you need to change your diapers?
Again? Wow.
So, Wayne, I thought long and hard... And I read on the forums today or yesterday or some other the hell day, I'm not sure which one it was, that you had some troubles with your comic book collection. So I went out and got you a gift. So here you go, Wayne.
Are you going to drop your pants again, Pat?
Later, yes. I figured this would help with your problem.
Ultra strength.
Yes, it's ultra strength, too. I don't skimp on the cheap stuff.
So next time you're picking up heavy objects like comic books, you'll have Ben Gay.
Yeah.
So what started all
be sure and slather yourself up with some extra strength Ben Gay.
So what started all this was my wife gave me my birthday gift early. She had her mom custom make a comic book storage cabinet. I mean, this thing looks beautiful. It's kind of like a bookshelf meets a card catalog.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
So it's beautiful, huge cabinet. It holds maybe about 1,500 comics or so.
Wow.
So at that point, it's like, well, damn, I've got 5,000 in the basement. What do I want to bring upstairs? So I spend the next 2 days in the basement moving around boxes, sorting out comic books, trying to figure out what I'm going to take upstairs. To the point that Monday morning, I wake up and my back is hurting so much that I'm popping Tylenol just to be able to walk, because these things are heavy, and I'm lifting 2 days worth of organizing these. I see the jaw drops at the 5,000.
That is a lot.
I have 3,000 more in storage still.
Oh, my God.
I had a guy back up in Duluth who had a comic book collection like that. Basically, he used his comic book boxes as the legs for the table that we would game on. And
I have a room in the basement that this was to his, them, actually, right now.
I'm sorry, I didn't know anyone lived in Duluth.
He said that his comic book collection was essentially his retirement fund.
It's not going to be worth anything at all.
That's a problem.
This is 20 years worth of collecting. And I've gotten rid of about 1,000 here or there that I've had my wife sell on Craigslist.
Wow.
But yeah, it's 20 years worth of comic
collecting. How many boxes of comics do you have? I don't know how many comics fit in a standard comic
box. Like the long box or whatever.
Yeah. The short boxes hold about 250. The long boxes hold 500 to 750.
Okay.
I used to have about 13 or 14 long boxes originally, and I realized that it was hurting too much to move them around, so I switched to all short boxes, and I've lost track of counting how many short boxes there are now.
Those short boxes will get away from you.
Oh, shit. I can't remember what I was going to say. Oh, yeah, you know what? After I went and saw Captain America, I went and dug out some of my old Captain America comics, as well as some of the Avengers. And this is back from, I think, probably late 80s, early to mid-80s. And, man, the writing is awful in those. I mean, they're just, it's just,
you
atrocious.
Don't say comic writing for superheroes is generally awful.
You know what? In and I understand 80s? That there's a certain level and threshold of this crap, but I didn't realize that it was that low, you know, or maybe my expectations
with
when
such
I was that age.
Were
you should try the
60s
and 70s.
Dumb, dumb Dugan.
I'm sorry, but comics are the playboys to the 13-year-old boys who can't get playboys yet. You don't look at them for the story, you look at it for
I
the
thought
art.
That was National Geographic.
Yeah. Maybe in your household.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Yeah, it was.
But no, I used to bitch about, basically the boxes are just so ugly to have sitting out. So I always bitch about, I want to go back and reread a bunch of this stuff, but it's all in the basement. So like I said, she went out and had this custom cabinet made. It looks beautiful. It's right next to our bookshelf. It's up in the living room. So when I want to go read things, I've got, you know, a whole cabinet full of 1,500 that I can pick and choose from.
Cool.
She used it for something else, like Story and the Cats or something.
Or Alan Moore's beard.
Okay, oh, Wayne, yes. Wayne, what was the first one that you decided to put up there? What was the first comic that you put up in that shelf? This is very telling of who you are as a person. So
the
what
entire
was
Ultimate
it?
Line. Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate X-Men, basically every Ultimate book Marvel's ever printed.
Ultimate Ultimo. All righty. So John's Kickstarter for Blood Moon Goblins is still up and running. If you're interested in donating to that to get on to some of the early prizes and whatnot, go check that out. I'll link it in the show notes. As of this recording, he has reached his funding goal. So I still recommend getting out there for one of two reasons. One, if you haven't yet, the video is pretty damn funny. And secondly, he has put up a plan explaining how he will spend the overages. And so that money will go towards stuff. And you can still also...
That update email was hilarious, by the way. And that's another reason, if you haven't donated, you might as well just to read the update emails as
well,
they come
and
in.
Also, the prizes are still valid. So that money will go to something. You can still get the prize awards for donating at the various levels. So don't hesitate to still go out there and take a look at that site if you get a chance. And we look forward to seeing that develop. Now, Chris, you had something you wanted to plug as well, and then we will get down to brass tacks.
Oh, I bet there's all sorts
get
of things Chris
to
wants to plug.
Yeah.
His urethra.
But Pat's what? Here, so...
Yeah, I heard absolutely nothing of what you guys said.
Move the headphones over to your hearing aid ear, and then...
Well, no, it's like I was talking while you were talking, and that just never works. Anyway, yes, Dan, for those of you who enjoyed Wayne's serial fiction on skiesofglass.com, and if you didn't go and enjoy it, you should, a new serial fiction piece set in the Skies of Glass universe has begun, and some of you may remember the Skies of Glass webcomic, which started, then stopped, and then kind of died. Basically, this would be the fictional adaptation of what that comic would have been. So we're taking that entire story, and basically I'm converting it into a story. And putting it up there. It comes every Monday, right around 8 o'clock there. We've got the nice little scheduled release dates. And yeah, please, by all means, check it out and tell me either how much you like it or how much you think it sucks.
So, Wayne, when your story ended, it was, what, 47 installments?
I think I took it to exactly somewhere around there, somewhere around 50.
Okay, so close to 50 installments. Yeah. Chris, do you have any wild idea how long yours is going to run?
How many parts? You know what? Honestly, I don't know, but I'm going to say it's probably going to come out to about as long as Wayne's. So we're probably going to be shooting somewhere between the 40 and 50 update range, but we'll see. We'll see. It's actually, the story is... you know, there, and it's extensive, and it's really interesting, and we'll see where it ends up.
That could very well be a new, you know, subtopic for the show as things go on. Things that are almost as long as Wayne's. I mean, we could cover all sorts of ground with that.
Musical introduction.
That would make the show absolutely muppetational. We're doing it.
Wayne's Awkward Measurement.
For today's episode, we're going to go back and talk about invasion stories a little bit more. Now, when we were first outlining the show, we did not intend for this to be a two-parter. And at the end of the last episode, I really didn't think, we'd need to come back and do a part two. But after watching some of the discussions on the forums...
they realized I had to be here, so...
we'll see if that holds up if you gave the same opinion on this you did in the pre-recording dinner. But we realized there's a fair amount of stuff here that we didn't cover and we want to come back and hit. Some of it we didn't touch on at all. Some of it we kind of mentioned in passing, but really didn't explore with the depth that deserved. Enough setting it up. Let me go ahead and get down to it. There are first two little mini topics I want to hit on related to invasion stories, and then two bigger ones. And incidentally, some of these came either in whole or in part from folks on our forums or on the blog. And I don't have specific name credits with these, because in some cases, multiple people raise the point. But just so you guys know that we really do pay attention to this stuff. But the first one that someone brought up is when I said the invading force needed to be very well fleshed out and three-dimensional, they came back with, well, what about if you have an invasion that's being conducted by something that by its very nature is not a deep character or collection of characters? For example, a zombie outbreak. It's not exactly an invasion, but it certainly has many characteristics of a willful, organized societal invasion. Another example would be something like 40K, a bunch of gene stealers show up and start a xenomorph surge or something like that. You certainly have an invasion going on, but there is nothing about the invaders that is social, negotiable. There's no character depth whatsoever. It's just built into the way they are.
I think in the circumstances you're talking about, I really don't think that's an invasion story in the same kind of category as the genres you were talking about. I think that's a natural disaster story, you know, and I think zombies and I think gene stealers and I think those mindless predation, something horrible is rolling in that can't be dealt with. It can't be talked to. It is just going to destroy everything.
Right.
That's not even the same genre.
What you just said is part of the reason why it got left out of the prior episode, was thoughts about those kinds of things did briefly cross my mind for a simple reason that if you were to pull a dictionary out and read the entry for invasion, sure, that would fit the definition of invasion. In fact, they talk about that. They refer to, for example, these fish up in the Great Lakes as an invading species.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think some of the subtext of the topic as we described it in 243 was that we were talking about a willful, intentional act of one culture or society to try and subjugate or take resources from another.
And from a storytelling perspective, those are totally different.
Their brains, for example.
But I did think the subject at least deserved a mention under the heading of invasion stories. If what you're dealing with is some kind of a force of nature, whether you consider this truly an invasion story or not, it is absolutely true that in those cases, the enemy would not, should not, could not have deep motivations and heavy backstory and all this kind of stuff.
Now, there are exceptions to that. For example, in a zombie invasion, if there is a motivating force behind the zombies, that it's not just cosmic rays struck the graveyards, if it is an evil necromancer that has summoned up the zombie horde, that changes it entirely.
Or a rogue government agency created the virus.
Horrible corporation or something like that.
I guess the big difference, too, is in the best zombie stories that I've seen, read, or listened to, the zombies are never the story. They're the background setting. It's all about the human interactions.
Right.
And the way we were describing the invasion itself was the story.
Well, and let's move forward then to micro topic number two here. which is the invasion as a backdrop. This was something else that someone put out there that we kind of mentioned in passing, but didn't really deal with. Let's say, for example, that you're playing characters who really don't have a dog in the fight. They're street thugs. Whether there's an invasion going on or not, you kind of live life in the underground the same way. It's Battletech. You're on one of the farming worlds where you don't really care. You just hoist a different flag based on who rules the world. The area's conventions keep them from fighting in your city anyway. And therefore, beyond that, you don't give a damn. Some real world examples of this that were given to us were some of the families that were living in Poland, where when the Nazis rolled in, their lives, obviously, in many cases, were radically altered, in many cases, much for the worse. But in some cases, life just went on. It just was a different flag flying for certain people. It's very hard to live in that kind of world and not have it affect you eventually. For example, let's say you're living in Poland in World War II, and your particular neighborhood is on the outskirts of who knows where, and really neither the Soviets nor the Nazis are bothering you. What happens the day that a Jewish family knocks on your door asking to be hidden? You're involved. Or you go out there and commit a crime because you're playing a bunch of street thugs, and the mayor is going to give you one punishment, but the Nazi marshals might give you another. Suddenly, you're involved. You have a dog in the fight. And so even in those stories where the invasion is purely a backdrop, I don't think it's an invasion story, because that's not just an invasion setting. It's a setting element, except for the fact that setting has this nasty habit of creeping into and derailing or changing the expected plot.
Absolutely. And I think in the hands of a talented storyteller, that is probably the most effective way of dealing with the invasion story. Because, you know, in all honesty, the underdog fighting against the evil oppressor is a story that's been done and overdone so many times that everyone knows when they walk into it everything that's going to happen in your story. You just change the name of the MacGuffin. But to simply back it off and make the invasion a simple part of the setting, if you can pull it off successfully, really turns it into a real story in my mind. And I think you can get a lot of mileage out of that that you couldn't out of simply the rebels fighting against the Russian front or whatever.
So I think you hit on one of the points that is Dan's next talking point, the other side of that coin, being the evil oppressor trying to crush this rebellion that's you can't seem to get rid of.
Well, just to clarify, getting into today's major topics, it was not playing the evil oppressor. It was playing the invader.
Right. And which we actually did in our most recent game.
Well, right. And the distinction I want to draw there is when you are playing the invader, if we want to simplify this, you could make kind of a matrix of 2x2. Going across the top, is the invasion done for fundamentally decent reasons or indecent reasons? And obviously, no situation in life is that clear cut. But I'm just saying, for the sake of argument, you could say. And then going down the other side, you have, do the characters agree with it or disagree with it? Is this an invasion being done for good reasons, but for whatever reason, the characters don't think so? Is this an evil invasion, but they're against it? Is it like our most recent D&D campaign where we were the invaders and we're evil and we're entirely in favor of the invasion?
And that's one thing. Whatever the answer is in each one of those squares, that's okay. And that's a different, interesting story.
Yes.
I really think that from a character perspective, you're only going to get two answers out of the four squares. Either it's a justifiable invasion and the characters are in support of it, or it's not justifiable invasion and they're against it.
I think it's entirely possible to have it not be a justifiable and the characters are also for it. I think you can get three possibilities.
Well, I'd say you can get all four. I have both run and played in games where an invasion was occurring by the side that I was on, and it was a reasonable invasion and the characters disagreed with it. It goes back to what I said setting this up. I'm drawing a simplified matrix here. But once you get into the minutiae of storytelling, no situation is that straightforward.
All you have to know is that history is written by the victor, so it doesn't really matter one way or another. Whoever wins, they're going to become automatically justified, and it was justifiable reason. So there you go.
Well, I think beyond that, not only is history written by the victor, but the present is written by the participant. Anybody who is going to support an invasion of another country, they're going to have their own justifications for it, and they're going to feel that it's legitimate.
People Anybody generally don't think of themselves as a bad guy.
Exactly. Everyone is the hero of their own story.
Yeah.
That's universally true. And that's why I say there's really only two answers to that square. Because everyone is going to be the hero, either fighting against the oppressor or fighting against the...
Framed that way, I can't disagree with you. Because you made a slight distinction of word choice there, which is justifiable. Mm-hmm. You didn't say right, because they were getting to something that is objective.
Yep.
But you said instead justifiable. You know what? There were a whole lot of people that supported what Hitler was doing.
Yeah.
There are a whole lot of people that supported what the Mongols were doing. We can go on and on throughout history like this. I won't get into more recent events because I'm not trying to start any political debates here. But the point being that there are all kinds of invasion stories where, as you said, everybody is the hero of their own story.
And even within that paradigm, you still can get a lot of gray. I mean, even rolling back to the World War II analogy that you had, the Nazis invaded Poland and probably believed that they were doing the right thing. The Russians invaded Poland, believing that they were doing the right thing. And the Polish just got invaded. You know, it doesn't matter whether the wolf wins or the bear wins, the rabbit still got it. And so you get two sides that from the invaded's perspective are both wrong, but from the invader's perspective, we're both right. And so there's a lot of gray that can be cast onto everything, but from most people's perspective, what they're doing is the right thing.
Well, I've actually had some fun doing that because years ago, I was playing a Star Wars game. I was playing a soldier on the side of the Empire. And in order to play the character, I had to come up with a series of internally consistent, cogent reasons that he would give for supporting the Empire.
There's a lot of them there.
And I did not want fear to be on the list. And so I had this whole spiel he could give if challenged, and he was challenged several times throughout the plot, where he would say, look, you have this massive bureaucracy that claims to be elected, yet is being manipulated all the time by an unelected theocracy. Mm-hmm. You had wars and pirates and all this other stuff going on. The Empire came in, brought consistency, order, peace. Commerce is working. People generally live in safety, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, some folks disappear in the middle of the night, but you know what?
The trains get there on time.
The trains get there on time. And so he had reasons that
those people probably
could explain to give why the Empire was doing the right thing and to justify to himself why fighting on their side was the right way to be.
Absolutely. I really think that's an excellent example because I've thought that watching the Star Wars series of, those Empire people, they kind of fixed a lot of stuff. Hard time saying they're in the wrong, but
Rebels are dicks.
They kind of are, yeah.
Do you know how many independent contractors had to be on the Death Star?
Exactly.
Thank you, Wayne.
I'm just saying.
Oh, my gosh.
Somebody just whip out the construction of the Death Star employ.
Think about all those people. It's horrible.
There's roofers. There's plumbers.
Not only are the people dead, but all those jobs are gone.
Exactly. You know, the unemployment now is
Death Star.
Actually, the unemployment problem is fixed.
On
they're
the
all
downside
dead.
Of the Empire, they really did not meet OSHA standards. All those platforms over huge abysses with no guardrails.
Yeah, a world without OSHA.
All I was asking was for a damn railing. Do you think that could get that?
No.
Another angle you can play this from, because it was mentioned earlier in our discussion, but we kind of strayed away from it, so let's come back to it, is you are playing part of the invasion force, but are against the invasion.
Are we talking like a double agent traitor sort of scenario?
Or maybe someone who wishes they were? You work for the Empire, you want to be a rebel, but obviously the rebels aren't going to trust you right off the shelf. And if you turn, quote, too quickly, you're going to be killed, potentially by either side. And so I think there's some interesting stories you could tell there.
Well, and then there's the people that are loyal to the Empire. They believe the Empire is right, but they don't necessarily believe in this invasion. During the course of the game, how do you try to help the rebels without betraying the people you actually do support?
Or you could take that even a step further and have sympathizers with the invaders who are native to the land that's being invaded. You know, rolling it back to the previous example, you have the Polish who are siding with the Russians, but the Russians aren't going to trust them because they're Poles. The Poles don't necessarily trust them because they side with the Russians. And how do you work that out? And that might be an interesting perspective to cast a group into is, you know, your land is being invaded by somebody who you think is going to make things better, but all of your neighbors disagree.
Right. And I think this really, in some ways, fits into what we said in 243, where I talked about how the invaders need to have detail to them. Along those lines, if your characters are part of that invasion, then those characters need to have detail. Because if you have a character who doesn't at any point wrestle with any of this, it's probably not a terribly deep character. If the world is cut and dry, black and white, it's obvious good and evil, okay, maybe in like certain settings, fantasy being a big one, that type of thing works. The orcs are just plain evil. That is fundamentally what they are. The knights are just plain good. That is fundamentally what I get that.
Really, I think if you have a setting like that, you're back to the zombie invasion. It's not an invading force. It's a force of nature. Sauron was not a conqueror. He was a hurricane. He was not somebody who could be bargained with. He wasn't after your resources. He was there to destroy Middle Earth, just like the zombie invasion was. So I really think that if you have that black and white, you've once again changed genre.
Just jumping back for a second, you were talking about being part of the invasion and not being a fan of said invasion. As a campaign, you know, looking at this over the course of really how many sessions and how much of a story can you really tell out of this, if you just want to tell the story about up until the point that they turncoat, honestly, unless you throw in the angle that Johan talked about, working with, you know, indigenous sympathizers and maybe turning them over to the rebels to try and prove some of your loyalty, I can't see that such a campaign like that being very long, unless you go into the, you know, the next step chapter after that with being, now that you've turncoated, now you have to go back and face your former masters, and then you have all kinds of plot lines that open up. But then you go from being the invader to being the invaded at that point.
I think it could be an interesting story arc to get there, though. Because basically, if the GM is seeing this direction happen, then you're presenting things to the players to tilt their perspectives. Because they have to come to that conclusion themselves of everything I have, all of my support that is, you know, these people I'm working for, I have to give all that up if I'm going to turncoat.
Well, and you also
that's an arc.
You also have the story angle of, I'm against the invasion. I've convinced the invaded that I'm honest about what I say. But they've said back to me, you're more useful to us on the inside. And I can think of tons of great storylines like that. Both versions of V had that. Final Conflict had that. There are tons of storylines I can think of that had really neat stuff where, yes, with one of the invaders turns, but is told to stay with the invading army. And they have to find some way to subvert what is going on without being so obvious as to be called out for their actions, at which point they die and are no longer an asset to anyone.
Yeah, they're both in more danger there, and they have to deal with the moral dilemma of they still have to keep doing the actions they were when they were actually on this other side.
Absolutely, and I think that can really bring up some interesting and fun situations to be in an experience. Absolutely.
This is probably something, though, that's going to be really tough to do in an actual game session for the simple fact that, you know, there's only a few scenarios where you're going to be running into an invasion story arc. One is that is how the game is set up. You're sitting down as the DM, you sit down with your players and you say, look, this is how this is going to go. You guys are going to be members of an invading army. You're going to invade this country. Make your characters. And unless you actually sit down with them ahead of time and say, you guys are going to be turncoats and double agents, then you have to manipulate your own players so much that they turn against their own side without feeling that they're being railroaded into it, because that would kind of make the game suck. Or this is part of an existing campaign, which makes it even worse, because you've got an established setting that you're going to try to turn the players against their allegiances that they've had for possibly years of real time,
right?
Which is going to be even harder to do artfully and harder to predict that you're going to be able to do it.
Well, I think more than that, it would be hard to do it to the group without either pre-planning or metagame consent.
Right.
It would be hard to take four or five diverse characters and find a plausible way by which all of them would change their mind.
Other than, you guys just found out you work for Sauron.
I think stories like this are much easier if set up the game and you start after the invasion. That doesn't mean the invasion itself isn't a fun story to do. It's just that if this is the feel you're going for, if you want them to rally up against their own people or rally against their invaders, I think it's easier to set that up because you don't know what the players are going to do by just building it into the backstory. Well, start at that point.
For the sake of argument, while this is not the type of game that I would tend to run, Chad, who, for anyone who's wondering, Chad's missed the last few episodes because he's dealing with some work stuff. He will be joining us again. He's not like quit the show or anything. He's just missing a stretch of shows. But if he was here, I can imagine one of the things that Chad would say.
He would say, I was on Kick to the Dice Bags last week.
Oh, I can imagine something else he'd say, which is... That,
which is that he would approach it from the perspective that the players will do either one.
And he'll that's fine with him. That yeah. What he would say yeah. is, look, you have a group of four people. One of them's like, wait a minute, this is crap, I'm out. One of them's like, I'm flag-waving patriot, you can't move me. And two are caught between with mixed emotions. He would say, you know what? That's a great story. Let's keep going.
And if you're a Chad GM, this is excellent.
Yeah. I mean, that type of group disparity... I mean, unfortunately, you may be careening towards the end of campaign when one character shoots another, but...
Well, to mention just simple management, it's one thing to split the party and do, okay, you group, this group does this, okay, now let's switch over here, but this would be constant, and it would be very difficult to manage.
And I think, really, unless you're going into it with a concept of metagaming it and pre-planning exactly what everyone's eventual motivations are going to be... You have to either really be open as a DM and be willing to tell either storyline, either, you know, they work with side A or side B and you're not going to care which side they go to and you've got a story ready for either way, or I don't even know that there's an or. You just have to do that, or you've got to pre-plan the whole thing right up front.
Wouldn't it be cool, though, to do a like chapter type thing where you did the invading force initially, mm-hmm. and then once you're invaded, everyone makes characters that was the invaded, and you're dealing with the aftermath of what your previous characters had done.
I think that has potential to be really interesting.
I do too, and I think...
Oh, absolutely.
You know what? A great story for illustrating both sides of one conflict, we'll go back to World War II, America and Japan. America started off with it and its allies being the invaded by the Japanese, and then ends with us... Well, we never actually got onto the mainland, but invading the outskirts of Japan, then, of course, dropping the A-bomb. There's a documentary I've mentioned out here several times in the context of nuclear war, which is White Light, Black Rain. And one of the things that's fascinating to watch in that is the interviews with the American crew of the Enola Gay and how all of them talk about the atomic bombing. And you get every opinion in there from, you know what, they'd have done it to us if they could, screw them, I'm glad we killed as many as we could, to I wake up every night thinking, my God, what did we do? And this was in one plane, you know, one crew, and you have every point on the spectrum of reactions to this event. Now, of course, at the end of the day, one bombing run, especially when they didn't exactly know what they were carrying, was not enough time for a really deep moment to occur where one of these guys might switch sides or simply go AWOL and ditch both sides. You didn't have that amount of time. I mean, they were sent out, they dropped it, they came back home, boom, excuse the pun. It was over, it was done with. There was no length of time here for these people to have any kind of a quandary until it was over, at which point they now have to reconcile and live with the event that had occurred. And, you know, there's still a debate to this day. Was it justified or not? It's a debate I'm not going to wade into because it's too political. But my point being that from a character standpoint, you had a diversity of opinions on that one event. And it's a great illustration of how quickly that can happen to a group of well-developed characters. In this case, the characters being well-developed because they were real people.
I think what I'm struggling with in listening to this conversation is that all the examples that we're giving of typical invasions, you know, the invaders, the invaded, are either historical or they're well-known properties, like, you know, using the Star Wars or something like this. I think the problem that I'm having is in a game, if you're trying to run a game that you've just made up as a DM, you're not using an established universe. Mm-hmm. I think the hardest thing that you've got going is without knowing the history and having an appreciation of both sides of, you know, your invaders and invaded. I think that it's going to be terribly hard for me as a player to have any sympathy one way or another.
Yes.
Now, if I'm going into Star Wars, I know exactly what it means to be either be a rebel or an Imperial soldier. If I'm talking about, if we're going to play a historical game, you know, well, even take for another example, you're talking about negative connotations, but the British Empire was an example of invasion. I mean, at one point they nearly ruled the globe, but mm-hmm. you wouldn't necessarily think of them as super bad guys. You know, some obviously the people they probably took over did, but you have that context of what it really means. And I think if you're just starting cold and saying, okay, you guys, we're in this brand new world, brand new setting, you're playing this one side and there's this other side and you're going to be in invaders and everything, I'm just like, I have no feel for it.
Pat, this takes us wonderfully into today's other major topic, which is narrating or working through or playing out the invasion event.
Mm.
We talked about it a little bit. And one of the things that we noted was that it can be difficult to do because, one, invasions tend to take a while. Sometimes they happen overnight, literally, but oftentimes they don't. The other thing is it's very hard to imagine how you would behave if one day your entire world was turned upside down. And with those difficulties set out, Wayne commented, based on the kind of story you might want to tell, it might be easier to simply fast forward post-invasion and play it's already occurred.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean the invasion isn't fun as well. It's
right.
Just for that type of story.
But we never backed up and actually dealt with the invasion event. And Pat, I think my answer to how I would introduce that in a new setting when you're not familiar with, well, it's not history or an established right. IP, lies in this, how I would tell the invasion story. But since I said Chris could talk first, I will turn it over to Chris so he may answer you.
And all right, so tell me when he's done, then I'll actually start paying attention
okay.
and listen what your
all right,
answer
I'll wake
is.
You up. Go ahead.
You're taking a nap? Excellent. First of all, Pat, you're 100% correct in how you would feel in regards to that kind of stuff. If this was my campaign and I was doing that, what I essentially would do, depending upon the genre that this was set in, I would essentially do some write-ups of background information in the form of either, if it's a modern setting, news reports, if it's a fantasy setting, epic poems from both sides of the invasion. Something that gives the setting a little bit of life and a little bit of depth and stuff that you may not necessarily encounter, but it immerses you in that setting and gives you a perspective and feel for the world that you're entering in. And then I would just essentially give both sides to all the players for them to read, take a look over, and then let them personally, based on their characters, make the decisions and have their own feelings about what they want to do and present it to them in a neutral fashion so that they could go and figure that out. And then just move on from there. But I would take myself out of the equation because I wouldn't want my own body language or anything else to reveal my hand as to which direction I would like them to go. So I would just present this in kind of a neutral way and then let them do what they want to do and then roll with it from that point forward.
In our last game, Chad took this in a completely different direction. There was an invasion going on from essentially the beginning of the first chapter all the way through to when the game ended. The Night Ripper's army was invading, mm-hmm. and we didn't know how we felt about it. It's just bits and pieces came out throughout the course of the game. You would see one general behaves this way, one behaves a different way. They're very different individuals. And by the end of it, we had kind of all made up our minds what we thought. But we didn't have a clear cut, which side should we be on this? Both sides had potential things going for them, and it was our choice at that point. Who are we going to side with? And it was the long haul game.
Chris, I think you have a good idea, but I think the danger there is if you dump too much encyclopedic information on the group right up front, that sometimes in itself can be a bit too thick, a bit too... I mean, this is a mistake that I've made. And
I'm not talking about producing a treatise on what's going on. I'm talking about giving short... Well, let's assume it's a modern-day setting. So you do maybe on one or two pages tops, you've got maybe three short blurb stories about things that may have happened of the invasion on both sides. So the most they're going to really read is about 4 pages, and that's 4 pages with breaks in between, so it really probably really work out to about
a
page
and a
half.
Have you ever had players, Chris? Because I've never once known a single player who is not me to read 4 pages of background information, and I'm weird, but
you're not visualizing what I'm talking about. You're thinking like it's 4 pages of single space, 6-point type. That's going
okay.
on. No.
I've never known
no.
a player to read 4 sentences of background information that I typed up, handed to them, and didn't actually sit down at the table and explain.
Most of the people I game with, I mean, come on. If you can't read, honest to God, if you can't read a simple 2-page handout that isn't even that dense or heavy, what are you doing even sitting at the table? Why are you even playing this game? Are you not? You're not. That's not even buy-in from your players. You don't even belong at that table.
I totally disagree with that.
No, come on. You're there to game. No. You're there to game. Read the damn handout. read the damn handout. My goodness, you're not making, the GM is making an investment,
Chris is
leading
me over
of
now.
A little bit of time and text. And if you're into play in this world and you want to play, if you want to be at the table, you're going to read a small handout that he's going to give you. My God, how difficult, how lazy can players be?
Extremely.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. They can be.
I understand that. And that's why I'm not saying you're not going to hand them the player's handbook and say, hey, before we start, I want you to read this entire manual. So start now and let me know when you finish, then we'll pick it up. No,
well,
you're not going to
do
that.
I like handouts, I mean, no, but I think the better GM will just bring this out in game.
Well, here, let me separate reality from who is it, the is-ought problem that, who is it that's not Hume, that was just, I don't know, whoever it was, the is ought problem here. Johan is describing what is, and Chris is describing what ought to be.
No, I'm also describing what is, because when I ran my,
you're too old to be this stressed.
My very successful campaign.
His agit
I gave,
is up.
Whenever my players entered a new town, I gave them each a single page handout that had maybe about a total of 20 total lines on there, and these were all either clues or red herrings or whatever, but what they were was things that involved stuff that they would encounter when talking with people and individuals in these towns.
I hate to tell you this, Chris,
some players,
I will
admit, some players did not read them all. Some players did, and there was different information on each sheet. And as a whole, it enhanced the game.
So I have played with a variety of players as well, and I have had a couple who would listen to historical explanations or read background information I have sent out.
I showed up at your first Skies of Glass, my first Skies of Glass game, with a printout of the history of Skies of Glass. That doesn't mean I think anyone else does that.
Yeah. The reality is I've also had a lot of people refuse to read anything, tune out during the explanations, get bored during the explanations. And I think it's sometimes because of the fact that at this point they have, well, some of it's the baby bird mentality that I've raged against in the past. They want Mama Bird, the GM, to go out, find the worm, eat the worm, digest the worm, and puke it back into their mouth while they do nothing. And Chris, I'm 100% with you in your rage against that. I think players, quite frankly, ought to be willing to bring a contribution to the table and work with the game master instead of just sitting there passively to help make this a good game. But having said that, I think one of the difficulties in presenting setting in that fashion for the player is up to this point, they have no buy into it. Their characters have experienced nothing in this world. They've experienced nothing in this world. All they're hearing is a string of proper nouns, and they may kind of piece together real high level stuff like, wow, it sounds like proper noun A screwed over proper noun B, but they really have no truly emotional context to that.
I, as a player, may make a decision based on that. I would have a hard time having my character make
a
decision.
Now,
my character has an experience.
Let me spin an alternate solution, which is, in the old nature-nurture debate, my answer is both. Have them make characters. Explain to them the basic setup. You are in a kingdom. Tell them the real basics that they would need to make a character. That's all you need to tell them. Throughout the course of the first couple games, and this gets into how do you tell the invasion story? Well, look, invasions, they have a context and they have a duration. Now, the context, obviously, is the moment in history, the moment in culture in which the invasion occurs, and it's the non-military conflict that led to the military conflict, a cultural clash, a resource division, something that triggers the oncoming martial conflict. And then the invasion itself is a progression of events during which an outside force arrives at and tries to subdue a local force. And what I would do in that situation is I would say, okay, in order for you to have any buy-in in this, in order for you to know how you might react to the invasion, I have to play at least a little bit of this game prior to the invasion. I have to come up with a plot or two, not full-blown campaigns, but a couple sittings worth of games where you guys deal with things around town. You're sent by the king to go and break up the local thieves guild. Well, now you've had interaction with the king. You've had interactions with the locals. You've seen what the thieves guilds are doing. The street rat on the corner helped you by dropping some names. When you were injured, the baker let you hide in the back of his shop so that you could patch up your wounds. You are starting to build a connection to the world. And that connection to the world has nothing to do with the invading force. During that time, you may encounter someone who tells you about current events, gives you varying opinions on the state of the world, the things outside. You see the best that this place has to offer, but you also see its worst. Then once you get to the invasion, I'll go back to use history as a guide. Look up invasions from whatever time period you want to. If you can, find historical accounts, even better yet, find eyewitness accounts, especially of modern events, of what it was like to live through an invasion. And now all of a sudden when that occurs and you have a sense that you were given in the game of one, what the world is like, and two, you have thereby decided on your own what you care about and why you should care about it, now that invasion will start to make sense. Now, exactly how the invasion occurs and how many days it takes to occur and all that stuff, obviously that's going to depend on a lot of things. The level of technology, how willing the invaded are to fight back versus roll over and take it. There's all kinds of things that figure into that. It could go on for hours. It could go on for years. But nonetheless, I think you have to give the players some sense of what life was like prior to the invasion if you're going to expect them to have any investment in or any realistic context of how to put themselves into the invasion event. And then how you tell that invasion event, look, you go after the things they care about. If they care about the plight of the poor, one side or the other is going to use that as propaganda. If they're really invested in the baker, guess what? At one point, his bakery is going to become the middle of a battle. You keep putting what they care about in the middle of that invasion and let their emotions go, either A, however they'll fall naturally, or B, maybe you steer things a little bit if you want them to prefer a particular side. Mm-hmm. If you want them to side with the invaders, maybe the invaded, in a moment of panic, decide to commandeer the guy's shop and he refuses and so they kill him. It's not per se a black and white issue of the empire, but maybe that one action is going to start to sour you against the country you should otherwise be defending, or vice versa.
All right, well, let me ask you this, Dan, because you've outlined very eloquently how to handle it from the invaded standpoint, but I ask you the same question and the same kind of a setup from the invader standpoint. If you're playing on the side of the invader, what do you do then
with this sort of background? The side of the invader.
I think he answered. I think his statement goes for both sides.
Well, but you're talking about the buy-in, though. I guess I'm trying to see what type of motivation when you give, you're having them interact with the world itself to have things they care about before you're invaded.
Right.
I mean, what do you envision doing on the flip side of that to motivate for the invaders?
I think you have to do the same thing. Set up what life was like. Set up the context. Let me give you a real world example that I will not comment on without being as neutral as I possibly can, because I'm getting right into a political hot topic here. And please, folks at home, understand I'm not trying to set off anything here. I'm just trying to go with what I know to help people understand this. I live in a country right now that in the past two or three decades has invaded multiple other countries. Okay. I know which of those conflicts I agreed with and disagreed with. I know prior to each what the historical and social context was of what was going on in my country and what was going on in the world as a whole. I know what my life was like before the decision to invade occurred, during the invasion, and after the invasion. I myself am not in the armed services and never have been. However, I have many, many friends who either are or during one of these conflicts was in the armed forces and came back with a wide variety of opinions on how justified or unjustified those actions were, how right or wrong they were conducted, et cetera, et cetera. But I think these guys are right that the answer I would give would be the same for both sides. The only distinction is the story you're trying to tell. Are you trying to make them understand the place that's being invaded or the place that's about to invade? Because quite frankly, when we went into Afghanistan, it had a lot more to do with New York than it did Afghanistan. Now, once again, I'm trying very hard not to start some political firestorm here, so take this for what it is. But my point being, you guys can all, and by you guys I mean the listeners, can all silently think through, okay, what country do you live in your lifetime or in its recent history, in your parents' lifetime, grandparents' lifetime, was it invaded or did it invade another power? And if so, what were the feelings surrounding that? What was the real story that occurred there, the human story that occurred? And I think you can use that, not necessarily as a perfect jumping off point, because you're trying to do fiction here, but I think you can use that kind of as a well to draw some ideas from to help you frame the story in a way that creates a compelling narrative.
I think there's also potential for a story where you just are downright lied to about the people that you're going for. Like looking at Planet of the Apes, the humans at that point, the apes saw the humans as you know, these are just animals. There's no intelligence to them until Taylor shows up. And then suddenly one of them talks.
And then he finds a doll that can talk. And he's
take that from a space standpoint. You're part of a military coming down from an alien race. You've been told that these aliens that you're getting ready to fight, these are just vicious creatures. So you go into war, you play a session or two into war,
right,
and then you run across the village and you see they have a society. And you realize this whole time you've been under a false assumption. That's the kind of moments I think could make for a really interesting invasion story. And it makes you question what you were doing the whole time.
And I think the most important thing in my mind from what everyone's saying, and really the fundamental place where I'm kind of disagreeing with Chris, is the old adage of show, don't tell. You know, you guys are all describing things that you can do in game, you know, a direct face-to-face interaction, and it's experiencing for the player the setting that they're in, whereas I just don't think handing the players a sheet of stuff and saying, here, read this. Even if they do it, I don't think that's going to kick into their head any real understanding of the setting. Plus, I also don't think most of them will do it.
First of all, Johan, actually, you're correct. Show, don't tell is always a better way to go about doing it. You know, the problem you run into, and I guess it all depends on how you as a game master want to approach that as a campaign, because I feel that by showing, you can color opinions intentionally or unintentionally. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want to do that, you've got to really work hard to make sure that you're given as neutral a presentation as possible. But if you do want to color it, yeah, absolutely. Go ahead and verbally and with body language illustrate your point.
I think just giving background information in a written form is really hard to make any headway with, to really give people an idea of the setting, unless they're willing to devote an awful lot of time to reading it.
And I want different kind of information in that. I like the written backgrounds to give me an idea of what should my character know about the history of this world. I want high-level points, not going into any detail.
The campaign that I'm playing in right now is in a established and well-published setting that exists all over the place. There's tons of books. There's information on the internet. And I know absolutely nothing about it, because even though I like to think I'm a pretty good player and I keep up with the DM and I, you know, try to interact, I'm not going to go out and read a whole bunch of background information that I just don't care about. But I will tell you that every freaking dwarf we've ever met in that game was a dick. And if we were involved in an invasion of the Dwarven Empire, my character would be right there and fully supportive of it.
You're touching on what my feelings are, is because I look at role playing as collaborative storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
That is a verbal contract kind of a thing. It's for role playing. I want there to be that storytelling element. If I want to sit down and read a book, I'll read a goddamn book. I don't want to read any more than like what you're saying, Wayne, some high points about some shit. That's fine. I honestly have no desire to sit down and read even four pages of stuff about your, you know, what you've written up, because I would rather you sit down and we can talk about it. You can,
right.
You as a GM can tell me some points and I can ask you questions. It can be a back and forth. That's how I learn. That's how I become invested in your world.
Exactly.
Not reading paper. I find that just dry and boring, and it loses people. That's the thing. You've got to keep the attention spans of a gnat. You give them a book to read, or, you know, even a handful of pages, it's just not going to happen, like you're saying.
Yeah, and you're going to have diverse people within the group. Dan's going to be able to give something like that to me, and I'll read it, and I'll enjoy the backstory. Chad's not going to take one look at it if you send him something like that, because that's not what he wants out of a game. So if you're running a game for that, you, like everything else, you have to know your group and know what they are and aren't comfortable with and what they would appreciate. I appreciate handouts and tactical things sometimes, but that doesn't mean I wouldn't rather see it in game instead.
Mm-hmm.
And while I totally do agree with you, Pat, I have to say that you guys are completely misunderstanding the point that I was trying to make. You mean, you really are. You're totally, totally and completely missing it. But
I will give you here, because I think up against time. I don't know, because this episode is going to be edit heavy.
No, we can be done, because I feel that my point was made, and really, it doesn't. I don't give two. So that's fine. You guys just are completely misconstruing.
No. Are you going to give me the final point? We haven't had a final point that was just played wrong in a long time.
Because Chris, we had a conversation at dinner where I told you, Johan, want to fear the boots rules. We allow all kinds of opinions. We don't allow drive bys. If you're going to say that, you got to defend it. So let's try this again, Chris. I think we're up against time here. I think it's hard for me to tell because we got a bunch of phone calls and such that interrupted this episode. So,
and by
yeah,
we,
by
mean
we,
you.
We, I mean me. So I have no idea how long the final product is going to be, but guessing that we're up against time, would you then please explain to us what your point was or try to clarify what you think it is we misunderstood?
And how much you agree with me.
Well, and actually, I think my point was made in the original Rampage that I went on, but what happened is the way conversations sometimes go, and this is a very good example of stuff around the table. You guys actually played a really good game of Operator with what I said and turned what I said to be about four paragraphs of information into suddenly being, you know, being handed a book of stuff that you'd be forced to read that I'm going to shove down
four
your
pages.
Throat. And that's not, not the case. And the context with which I was making this in is that if you're trying to present neutral information to your characters, and you want to present it in a neutral fashion and let them make the decision for themselves, then that is one approach to do it. It is not the approach. It is one approach to do it. And if a player doesn't read it, well, that's just great. Go ahead. Don't read it. I don't care. It's there for you. I may use that information later on. And if you didn't read it, well, too f-ing bad. I guess you, as your player and your character, you're behind the ball on this one. You know what? And that's great because that's a real-world situation that's translated into the game. I don't require my players to read anything that I put in front of them. I put it there as a game enhancement. If they want to read it, great. If they don't, don't. And because you're absolutely right. You have the attention span of that. You've got to know your players. Don't give them boatloads of information. Nobody wants to read that. I, as the GM, don't even want to write that crap. But you give them enough that they can get exactly what Wayne said. He wants his highlighted points, or those high-altitude points. But you have to be able to also offer little bits and details in there as well, because you've got to give your campaign a little bit of feel and a little bit of realism in what they're getting into, and things like
Chris,
that example.
Let me ask you a double advocate question here. We're all in agreement. If you throw down 200 pages of background material, the average player is not going to read it. Right, wrong, indifferent. That's just reality. But what you're describing, to take your other angle of, if you give them really abbreviated background information, you give them 2 to 4 pages, large type, double spaced, whatever, you know, it's something they can read in 15 minutes.
Something
right.
easily
something
digestible.
Digest, something they can read in 15, 20 minutes. Do you think this is really enough information for them to develop an attachment to the universe, to pick a side, and to genuinely care? Because I would have real trouble getting people, one, sufficient information to understand it, and then two, sufficient spin to care about it. In that short of a propaganda piece?
The short answer to that question is no, absolutely not. Because if I did depend just on that to have them make a decision, that'd be DMing on my part. This should really be some foundational things to maybe get them to think and then let them make decisions based upon then what they experience in the game.
Okay,
after
so your
that
point here is to kind of give them a running start on the situation, not to ask them for their final answer after 2 pages of... Okay.
This is no, sir, absolutely not. This would not be a be-all, end-all. Here, I want you to go and then I want you to check a box at the end of at the bottom of page 2. Absolutely not. This would just be, like I said, it's neutral. It's here's information, and it's simply information. It's told from one side and it's told from the other. Read it, let's game. And by read it, I mean, you even said 15, 20 minutes. I wouldn't even go that far. I'm talking like 3 minutes tops. I mean, something that they can read and you're done and you move forward.
I will have to say that, you know, from the perspective of like my current game group, there's 4 players. If the DM were to whip out a sheaf of paper that would take us approximately 3 minutes to read, unless we sat down at the table and read it, then what would happen is we would all take it home. The number of players who would read that is 0. The number of players who would know what was in it is 2, because 2 of us hang out with the DM outside of the sessions. We would chat with him. We would talk to him. Then I would explain to the other 2 players the content of that information, and it would be summarized into 3 sentences. Group A is piece of shit. Group B is awesome. And Group C, we don't know what's up with them. Done.
And you know what? Honestly, I think that that's pretty cool, because that too is a real world experience. And then I would love to then, as a GM, do, if I knew that that dynamic existed, I would actually purposely go and do something that might come back and bite you as the telling player in the ass from their perspective. You know what I mean? So that they say, wait a second, you never told us it was this. You said that Group A sucked, but you didn't say they sucked because of this reason. Well, I don't have any problem with that reason. And then that creates more fun.
I think that's where we're going to go ahead and end this topic. Don't forget once again to check the show notes. We got lots of stuff out there. As for upcoming episodes, I know we got several more interviews on tap. And also, at some point here, we need to start talking about Fear the Con 5, getting out some real details and look at getting Con Planner up so people can start creating activities, signing up for them. Based on some feedback from last year, we're going to do a couple things a little bit different, but one of them is for at least one of my games that will be using the D-Wayne system. I think I'm going to use a third-party site to do a lottery, an early lottery. We'll have a couple months to sign up, but I will simply pick randomly who gets to play and let them know well in advance. But we'll talk about that in more detail later on in future episodes. So thank you guys for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the discussion, and I think we're going to put Invasions to rest for a while. And next episode...
The invasion is over.
We've been uninvaded. We fended it off.
We dundid fend it.
So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will dundid catch you next time.
Later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.